From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I'm not a scholar. I'm just a res girl who grew up in Chicago and ended up in New York and has been doing some work for the people. And that's basically how I see my work and what I'm doing. It's always for the people, because sometimes the people can't get to where the voices need to be heard.
Native American activist Ingrid Washnawatok, executed in Colombia last week, along with Native Hawaiian Lahine Gay and environmental activist Terrence Freitas. Today, we'll talk about who they were, why they were in Colombia, and how they died. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. One of the three Americans kidnapped in Colombia and then killed was previously tailed by suspected right-wing gunmen, interrogated by police, and even received death threats. This, according to a close friend yesterday. Colombian and U.S. officials have publicly blamed the country's main rebel group, the FARC, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, for the murders of the three, whose bullet-riddled bodies were found in Venezuela on Thursday. But rebel commander Raul Reyes of the FARC's ruling general secretariat yesterday reiterated it was not involved. He said the FARC has no responsibility in these incidents. He blamed the killings on enemies of the country's fledgling peace process, a reference to illegal paramilitary gangs or disgruntled sectors of the military. Terrence Freitas of Oakland, California, Ingrid Washnawatok, an American Indian resident of New York, and Lahine Gay of Hawaii were snatched in northeast Arauca province on February 25th by two gunmen who wore ski masks, civilian clothes, and carried pistols. The trio were in Colombia helping the Uwa Indians defend tribal land rights from oil exploration by the U.S. multinational Occidental. Venezuelan authorities said their bodies would be flown to the United States this afternoon. We'll have more on that story in just a few minutes. U.S. fighter jets dropped laser-guided bombs on Iraqi anti-aircraft artillery sites in the northern U.S.-British imposed no-fly zone today, this according to a U.S. Defense Department spokesperson. Iraq says that one person had been injured in the attack. An Iraqi military spokesperson also said Iraqi air defenses had confronted the attacking aircraft and forced them to flee. President Clinton's envoy for African democracy, the Reverend Jesse Jackson, arrived in Nigeria today to meet President-elect General Obasanjo, this according to U.S. embassy officials. During a four-day visit, Jackson scheduled to meet with the military general Abdeslami Abubakar, as well as Obasanjo, who won an election on February 27th, defeating his rival, although there are serious questions that have been raised about the vote. During his visit, Jackson will also travel to the volatile oil-producing Niger Delta, where Ijaw youths have staged protests to demand a greater share of the region's wealth for their impoverished communities. This news from Turkey. A news agency close to Kurdish rebels said today they'd shot down a Turkish military helicopter in southeast Turkey, killing 20 soldiers. One officer was among the dead, the news agency said in a written statement based on reports from the National Liberation Army of Kurdistan, the military wing of the PKK. A spokesperson for the Turkish General Staff said he was unaware of any such report. The Coast Guard called off its search yesterday for up to 40 Haitians who apparently drowned while trying to enter the United States. Two boats loaded with refugees sank Saturday in the early morning hours. Crew members on a passing freighter reported hearing screams from the water about 30 miles east of West Palm Beach, Florida. Rescuers found only three survivors. The men rescued from the choppy waters of the Atlantic Ocean told the Border Patrol that one of the boats broke down and that the other boat approached to help. Both boats then went under, this according to the survivors. And a moderate from El Salvador's ruling right-wing party claimed victory early today in his presidential elections, but his win may not be large enough to avoid a runoff with a former guerrilla leader. With almost 80% of the vote counted early Monday morning, Francisco Flores of the National Republican Alliance, or RENA, led a field of seven candidates with just over 51% of the vote. the Election Tribunal reported. He would need 51% to claim victory outright and avoid a second round of balloting on April 18th in El Salvador, still struggling to heal wounds left from over a decade of military and paramilitary violence. That description, a moderate from El Salvador's ruling right-wing party, is Reuters' description. Tom Mok, the aging military leader of the now-defunct Khmer Rouge guerrilla group, was captured by Cambodian government troops this weekend and will be charged in connection with his role in leading the regime that was responsible for the deaths of as many as 2 million Cambodians in the mid-1970s. Known as the Butcher for his cruelty but commanding near-blind loyalty from his followers, Tom Mok was the last Khmer Rouge leader unaccounted for before his capture in the jungle near the Thai-Cambodian border. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A senior commander of Colombia's largest guerrilla organization said today his group will investigate whether its troops killed three American activists last week and will punish anyone found responsible. However, Raul Reyes, a member of the seven-member ruling junta of the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, known as the FARC, said up to now he sees no signs that his organization had any role in the killing of American Indian activists Ingrid Washnawatok and Lahine Gay and environmental activist Terence Freitas. The killings have sent shockwaves throughout the indigenous and progressive communities in the United States, where the three activists were well known and deeply admired. Washnawatok was a member of the Menominee Nation in Wisconsin, one of the most well-known American Indian activists, and Gay directed the Hawaii-based Pacific Cultural Conservancy International. The UWA Defense Working Group, where Terry Freitas worked, called yesterday on the State Department to investigate the possible role of right-wing paramilitary groups and also asked the FARC to clarify whether they had any part in the murders. Some are linking the killings to the U.S. oil multinational Occidental Oil, whose application for a drilling license in UWA ancestral land is pending before the Colombian government. The UWA is an indigenous community close to the Venezuelan border where the three activists were when they were kidnapped by an armed group in civilian clothing on February 25th. Freitas had been working closely with the UWA communities to stop Occidental from conducting exploratory drilling. According to the UWA Defense Working Group, Freitas had reported being followed and observed by individuals believed to be associated with paramilitary activity who are suspected of being allied with the oil companies. He also was forced to sign a statement by the Colombian military that essentially absolved them of any responsibility for his safety. We turn now to three people who knew the activists well and also are activists on the issue of Colombia. We're joined on the telephone by Victoria Maldonado, who is a Colombian filmmaker. She's been working on a film on indigenous communities. She works with the Colombia Media Project. Also joining us in our Washington studio is Melina Silverston, director of the Coalition for Amazonian Peoples and Their Environment, which also encompasses the UWA Defense Working Group. She has worked with the three activists, particularly on this latest trip to Colombia. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Melina Silverston, let us begin with you. What is the latest you understand about the killings?
Good morning, Amy. I think that what you just recently announced about the news from the FARC is the most recent update, that the FARC, the highest levels of the FARC, are going to carry out an investigation to see what they can find out, if it indeed was one of their units in Arauca that committed the murders. And I know that in Colombia there's quite an uproar and discussion and debate about what happened and trying to get to the bottom of it.
Can you describe what you understand as to be the circumstances of the deaths of these three activists this past Thursday?
Yeah. Terry and Lahe and Ingrid had been in the UWA territory for about a week in the community. They were meeting with them to develop an education project, a purely cultural project to help defend the integrity of the UWA culture in the context of violence which they're trying to survive. Lahe has experience developing a similar project in Panama that was very successful with an indigenous group there. Ingrid has, as you mentioned, is a leader of the native community here and is one of the people that has really served as a link between indigenous peoples of both of the north and south of the Americas. And Terry, because he has been for the past 2 years coordinating the UWA Defense Working Group, with us helping to defend the UWA people, in particular trying to convince Occidental Petroleum Company that they should leave the UWA territory. We know, we were in communication with them, and we know that they left and were on their way to catch a plane. Actually, they were leaving. They were going to Saravena, where they were going to get on a plane and come home. And we hadn't heard of any irregularities until that time, but they didn't get off the plane in Bogota, so that's when the investigation began. And the UWA told us that they were with them in the truck on the way to the airport, two UWA friends of ours. One of them is a leader and spokesperson of the tribe, Roberto Covarilla. Roberto said that they were stopped by armed gunmen. These gunmen were wearing masks and civilian clothing. They asked Roberto to step out of the car, which he did. They drove about 3 more miles, and the driver of the car was an UWA, also an UWA person. So he is to has testified the rest of the story. They drove about 3 more miles. They were asked to get out of that truck. They were put in another vehicle and driven away, and that was the last we heard from them. Now, the kidnappers told Roberto, our UWA spokesperson colleague, they told him that they were FARC and they were just going to carry out an investigation to find out who these people were. That's not an unheard of situation. The FARC often, as the other guerrilla groups also, will take people to find out who they are, make sure they're not spies, see what they're doing in their, you know, what they consider to be the territory that they control. They consider themselves the authorities. The UWA, as an indigenous group, did not consider them authorities. They consider themselves and their traditional elders to be the authorities. So there is historic conflict with the FARC on that issue. However, because they asked Roberto to get out of the car, most of us, maybe it was wishful thinking, most of us believed that they would be released in a few days. They obviously wanted witnesses because they let Roberto and the other person go. At that point, the UWA waited a day before they told anyone because, again, they were hoping that they would just be released, and the less sort of scandal around it, the more likely they would be to be released. Hmm. At that point, we started communicating daily, regularly with the State Department, the U.S. Embassy in Colombia. The FBI got involved because that's part of their role to investigate these types of occurrences. And the families began to talk and coordinate their position and their, you know, search for their for their loved ones. And a week, that was on Friday that we found out about the kidnapping that had happened last Thursday, the 25th. And just a few days ago on Friday, we got the news that their bodies had been found. They were identified by Ingrid's credit card that she had on her body. They were tied up and blindfolded and shot a number of times.
We're talking to Melina Silverstone, who's director of the Coalition for Amazonian Peoples and Their Environment, and she was close to all three of the American activists who were killed in Colombia. She describes what happens in the last week leading to their deaths on Thursday. Melina?
During the entire week that they were kidnapped, we put out a number of, statements from the families. The family also discreetly contacted the international FARC representatives, and the FARC never responded. They never denied that they had done the kidnapping, neither did they acknowledge that they had done the kidnapping, which is very strange. The ELN, which is the other large guerrilla group, which is the National Liberation Army that works in that region, right away denied that they had been involved in the kidnapping. The right-wing paramilitary squads in the region also did not acknowledge or deny any involvement in the kidnapping. Terry, because of his 2-year very intimate involvement with the UWA, does have a history in the region, and he has been threatened on a number of occasions by the paramilitary. Specifically, a message was left on his answering machine here in the U.S. that said, "Back off or die." And he was also followed by paramilitaries in the region. And he was, as you mentioned, forced at gunpoint to sign basically a disclaimer by the Colombian military saying that he would not hold the Colombian military responsible if something happened to him. In terms of the members of the UWA Defense Working Group that have been working with him, feel that there is very much of a need for a further investigation. It's not a simple case. And we don't know. We're not saying who did it. We really can't speculate until a very careful investigation is done, and we're calling on both governments to do that, to carry that out and find out what happened to our loved ones and try to avoid that, something like that could happen again. We feel very strongly that Occidental Petroleum is responsible. There's just no excuse for an oil company to be in a situation like that with that level of violence, that level of impact that their presence there has. They've caused a dramatic increased militarization of that region and many, many deaths, and we know there'll be many, many more. And, since they started trying to explore there, the UWA community, which is a community of about 7,000 indigenous people, have said they do not want oil in that region. They don't want the militarization, and they don't want the environmental impact, and they don't want what for them is a very spiritual impact of their Mother Earth being destroyed. And as you might have heard, they have said that they would commit mass suicide if oil is taken out from their earth, which is why Terry, who is a person who's was very committed to the environment, got involved.
Well, Melina, we're going to break for stations to identify themselves. And then when we come back, we're going to also hear from Victoria Maldonado about the Battle of the UWA. And we're going to hear tape of both Ingrid Washanwatak and Terry Freitas, both talking about their commitment to indigenous rights and to the UWA. We're also going to hear from a close friend of Ingrid's, Esmeralda Brown, who's worked with her on a number of indigenous organizations and over at the United Nations and the NGO Committee of the United Nations for the International Decade of the World's Indigenous Peoples. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Melina Silverstone will stay with us, director of the Coalition for Amazonian Peoples and Their Environment. Stay with us. We'll be right back. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman on this International Working Women's Day. We have a number of people to talk to, and we have the voices of the American activists who were killed in Colombia that we would like to play for you. Victoria Maldonado is on the phone with us, a Colombian filmmaker with the Colombia Media Project, who has done extensive work with the UWA. Victoria Maldonado, Melina Silverstone was just describing the battle of the UWA people. Can you place their area for us in Colombia and why it was so significant and so dangerous?
Hi, Amy. Thank you for having us in the program. Well, first of all, I wanted to join Melina in the call for an investigation for this latest crime of humanity, which has been too often happening in Colombia. Basically, the UWA community is located in the northeastern part of the country. Their ancestral territory is actually quite large, and it covers three departments in Colombia and a section in Venezuela as well. Although, of course, after many years of invasions of different sources, the actual UWA community right now lives in a smaller area within that region.
Hello? So tell us what the main struggle was now with the UWA.
Well, basically, in 1992, Occidental Petroleum got a license to explore for oil in UWA territory. This license was granted by the State Council, and it was a move that was very much done against the constitution of the country. The way they explained it was that oil exploration and the money that Colombia needed out of that exploration was took precedent to any indigenous rights that already existed in the country. So that was basically a violation of the constitutional rights of the indigenous people. And then by 1997, the UWAs came out to the world, and that's when they said they would commit mass suicide if indeed Occidental Petroleum would start the seismic explorations in their area. This is when there were a lot of campaigns, both in Colombia and as well as internationally, to support the UWA and to try to stop these seismic explorations and therefore to stop this massive suicide. And they were very successful. Actually, these campaigns were able to stop or at least delay any explorations by Occidental Petroleum, and there were a number of irregularities during this process in terms of the behavior of Occidental Petroleum towards the UWA people, and basically that's what's been causing a lot of turmoil in the area.
Well, Victoria Maldonado, we want to thank you for joining us from the Colombia Media Project, a Colombian filmmaker who spends most summers in Colombia documenting the struggles of indigenous people. We're going to turn now to Terry Freitas. Terry Freitas, one of the three American activists killed in Colombia last week. And this is an interview he recently did with Mario Murillo. He is the host of a weekly national news magazine called Our Americas. Terry Freitas describes the struggle.
Well, as you know, the UWA Pueblo has been trying to defend itself from Occidental Petroleum and Shell for the past 5 years or more, really. And what's happening now is that Shell, there's a minor victory. Shell has decided to sell all of its shares in the project. And so Occidental is continuing, and now Ecopetrol is looking for a new partner to become part of the Asociación Cravo Norte. So there's a number of oil companies out looking to become a new partner in the Chisamore project. And basically what the oil, but the problem is that Occidental is having a hard time finding a new partner. There's a number of oil companies who I believe are refusing to become part of any association with Occidental, because what Occidental has right now in its hands is a permit to mine within or drill for oil within the UWA territory. And more and more oil companies are realizing that this project is potentially genocidal for the UWA. They can continue with exploration anytime they have a permit for that. Technically in Colombia, they would have to have another consultation, but the way that consultation is defined in Colombia right now, as basically it causes a problem. It allows for the company to be able to talk with just random UWA people to get permission to drill on their land and not respect the actual UWA government. There's a UWA government that's even respected by the Colombian government, and Occidental doesn't even have to talk to those people in order to get a mining permit, which is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. So the next stage would be putting forth their environmental impact statement to the Ministry of the Environment, and then having the Ministry of the Environment accept that. And the Ministry of the Environment has basically stated that it would accept that, and they're all just waiting. And they're waiting because of the international pressure, and because of the international solidarity and support for the UWA people, but more importantly, because the UWA have stayed united in their struggle, even though Occidental and the Colombian government are trying their best to divide the community. It's been a lot better since Roberto actually talked about the threats. And since the UWA people received international support, I believe that the Colombian government and the oil companies are very aware of how much support that the UWA people in Colombia are receiving, and so they've stepped back any direct threats to the UWA people. But at the same time, they haven't acted directly or in any way that we can see to truly avert these threats. The easiest thing that the Colombian government could do to avert the threat would be to cancel the mining permit that Occidental has right now, to cancel the exploration permit, rather. And in Occidental could cancel its own permit and make, I mean, they have a lot of sway and they could easily get that piece of paper torn up. They could do it in an hour and they could do it legally, and all they would have to do is call up their friends in the Colombian government and get it done. And just that, as you know, just that would be a tremendous relief for the UWA people, because then they wouldn't have this shadow of death, essentially, just right above them. I mean, it's waiting. It very much seems like it's in the hands of the government, and that Occidental has this, they have this ace, they have this permit, and the Ministry of Mines just said last week that oil development will continue in this region. So to have that hanging over the UWA people like a shadow of death is not fair, and it creates a political situation in Colombia, that the same political situation that gets people killed every day.
That the late Terry Freitas, who is with the UWA Defense Working Group, also was with Project Underground. And in this last trip that he took to Colombia, was working with two other American activists. In fact, he was bringing them to Colombia for the first time, Ingrid Washnawatak and Laine Gay with the Pacific, with a Native Hawaiian group that was actually sponsoring this trip, the Pacific Cultural Conservancy International. And Ingrid Washnawatak is with so many Native American organizations, it's hard to lay them all out, and we're going to do that in just a few minutes and talk about her activism and hear a speech that she gave around the issue of 500 years of resistance. It was actually a speech she gave in 1992 as activists all over the country looked back at Columbus Landing in the Americas. But let me ask our guest, Melina Silverston, director of the Coalition for Amazonian Peoples and Their Environment, who was working with this, I guess you could call it a mini delegation in Colombia. I'm sure it was very hard for you to hear Terry's voice, but if you'd like to follow up on any point he made, this interview was done by Pacifica Radio's Mario Murillo last June.
Yeah, just, it was really hard to hear his voice, but I also just want to thank you, because I didn't think I'd ever hear it again. They were there in a very difficult circumstance on this last trip. While they were there on a cultural mission trying to set up an education project, as you know, there's other things going on in the country, such as the discussion of, dialogue between the FARC and the government, as well as continued discussion here in the U.S. Congress about military aid to Colombia, and that's all tied up in the drug wars and other things that are related. The question of oil and Occidental Petroleum is not over. It is far from over. Occidental is still there. They're still, at this point, have permission to drill in the ancestral territory. And the UWA are still completely united and against it. And I want to let the public know that we are going to do everything we can to continue that struggle and to continue supporting the UWA. And we welcome any of your support in that process. In particular, if any of you happen to have shares with Occidental, we really appreciate proxies. We'd like to bring some UWA people to their shareholders meeting. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, you mentioned it. How can people reach the Coalition for Amazonian Peoples and the UWA Defense Working Group?
We're based in Washington, D.C., the Coalition office, and you can call us. We're at 202-785-3334, and we can hook you up to the right group depending on what you can do.
That's 202-785-3334. Melina Silverstone, what was the response of the State Department while you were talking to them through the week that the three activists were kidnapped? People may remember recently the kidnapping of the bird watchers in Colombia who were released unharmed. They were kidnapped by the FARC. But what did the State Department say they believed who had kidnapped these three activists? And then after the killings, who they believed had done the killing?
Well, that was very frustrating, actually. My office is based in D.C., we were asked to sort of be the liaison with the government offices. And we're on the phone with them and with State Department up here, with the U.S. Embassy in Bogota, as well as some other offices involved, and on a daily basis, a few times a day. And we were told over and over again that not to believe that it's the FARC, that there's no evidence that it's the FARC, that in fact they don't, they didn't make any conclusive statement either way, but they said that there's no reason to believe it's the FARC. We, as I mentioned, maybe it was wishful thinking, but because the UWA believed that it was the FARC, we were also thinking that it probably was and that our friends would be released again because of the case of the bird watchers who we had actually spoken to. And that was every day, including the day of the actual murder of our friends. We were told that it's probably not the FARC. And then all of a sudden, mysteriously, overnight, they came out with this very, very clear, decisive statement that it was the FARC that killed them. Not just that it was the FARC, but it was the Marxist rebels, that sort of language. And it could have been the FARC. As we know, they're going to carry out an investigation. It also could have been a lot of other actors that need to be equally investigated. And we find it really confusing that they would just switch like that. Again, they have some evidence that they cite, which is the intercepted conversations on cell phones. But we know up here in the U.S. from many court cases how valid a tape can be. One thing that we're asking is that the tape be allowed to come here to the U.S. for analysis, where we have better, more sophisticated experience in analyzing those tapes. The FARC, the roadblock where they were stopped is usually a paramilitary roadblock. It is not usually a FARC roadblock. That's one thing that brings it into question. Another thing is that the FARC uniform is as the traditional rebel uniform in the Americas. It's a bandana across the face and fatigues. The people that kidnapped our friends were wearing civilian clothing and masks, like ski mask type masks, which is more the paramilitary costume. Again, we're not saying that it's one or the other. We're saying it's not that simple as, oh, they're dead, let's blame the Marxists so that we can increase military aid to Colombia. That's just too simple of an equation. It's more complicated than that, and we're not going to rest until there's a more thorough investigation done.
How will that investigation be done? The Colombian government says they'll investigate. We are talking about the Colombian military. The U.S. government, which has said they want to increase aid to the Colombian military, has said that what they are calling for an investigation as well. How will you be sure that an investigation is done impartially?
Well, we're consulting with people that are experts who have experience in this type of thing in Central America and other places, in Colombia and Peru. We know that we need some independent autopsies on the bodies, for example, Physicians for Social Responsibility. Another question that came up is the type of gun that was used. Apparently, I think it was a 9mm, is not the type of gun that the FARC ever carry. It's the type, it would be useless for the FARC. They carry, you know, machine guns, automatic weapons. Those types of things need to be looked at in an independent autopsy. Of course, the families right now are grieving, and it's hard for them to want to continue this type of political things. But one thing that we know is we don't want the death of our friends to be used to increase the violence in that country. On the contrary, we hope that it can be used to help bring about peace, because we know that that's what they wanted.
The families of the three Americans are headed down to Miami today to identify the bodies?
Yes. The Lahe will be going back to Hawaii, where she's a native Hawaiian. Her husband, Kamala's husband, is here and will be meeting her. Terry's family is out in California, and they'll also be meeting him in Hawaii. He's going to be buried in New Mexico, and Ingrid's family is in New York, but she'll be, her husband and her son, Maki, are in New York. She'll be moved. She'll be taken to Wisconsin to her native Menominee reservation.
Is there any last comments you'd like to make before we go to our break? And then we'll be joined by a close friend also of Ingrid Washin-Watok, who will basically talk about her indigenous activism. And we want to play then a speech that Ingrid gave a few years ago talking about her own activism. Malena.
Yeah, just that, you know, Ingrid and Lahe and Terry were well aware of the danger. It's been said a number of times. They really went out on a limb for the Uwa people, because the Uwa have such integrity. They're such a spiritual, united, traditional people, and they really saw the clear need to help. Shell pulled out of the Uwa traditional territory, and there's just no reason that Occidental can't also pull out. And as I said, we do hold them accountable, and we'd like to hear a statement from them. We haven't heard anything yet. And we, as I mentioned, are going to continue demanding a full investigation. We're also going to continue supporting the Uwa people. It's going to be harder, obviously, to go down there and be with them, but the struggle of our work with them will continue.
Well, Malena Silverstone, thank you for being with us, director of the Coalition for Amazonian Peoples and Their Environment. Again, the phone number in Washington, D.C., this group, by the way, encompasses the Uwa Defense Working Group, is 202-785-3334. 202-785-3334. You might want to stay, Malena, to listen to Ingrid in a speech she gave talking about what it means to be a Native American and what it means to be an activist. In just a minute, we'll speak with one of the women on this International Working Women's Day that Ingrid worked closely with for many, many years. Please stay with us here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
Gracias a la vida que me ha dado tanto, me dio dos luceros que cuando los abro perfecto distingo lo negro del blanco y en el alto cielo su fondo estrellado. Y en las multitudes del hombre que yo amo. Gracias a la vida que me ha dado tanto, me ha dado el oído que en todo su ancho.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, as we continue on this International Working Women's Day to talk about the three U.S. citizens who were killed in Colombia last week. It looks like last Thursday that Ingrid Washin-Watok, Lahe Gay, and Terrence Freitas were shot in the face and chest, and left on the Venezuelan side of a river on the other side, Colombia, shot and killed. We're going to now talk about Ingrid Washnawatok, who is a member of the Menominee Nation in Wisconsin. Her family headed there to bury her and to celebrate her life. On the phone with us is Esmeralda Brown. She's chair of the NGO Committee of the United Nations for the International Decade of the World's Indigenous Peoples, and it was a position that Ingrid had held before her. She is also Esmeralda Brown with the United Methodist Office for the United Nations. She herself is a Panamanian activist. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Esmeralda Brown.
Thank you, Amy.
Well, you've been listening to the program so far about the work of these three activists on their latest mission to Colombia. In the case of Laje and Ingrid, it was their first time in Colombia, though around the issue of activism, certainly not the first experience. Can you give us a little background before we go to a speech Ingrid gave on the 500th anniversary of Columbus landing in the Americas? Can you give us a sense of who Ingrid Washnawatok was?
Okay. I would say that Ingrid was a leader. She was an indigenous woman leader with an international vision of her peoples working together throughout the Americas and throughout the world to combat racism, you know, all kind of discrimination against indigenous peoples and other peoples of the world. Ingrid committed her whole life to her causes and brought to those efforts compassion, love, and peaceful work for peace with justice and self-determination by marginalized groups around the world. Ingrid was a person that, because being a Native American woman, was very sensitive to the situations of people throughout, the people of African descent, you know, African Americans, Latinos, immigrants as a whole, women, children. I mean, the war in Central America, and in particularly Guatemala, really affected her very much, and in fact committed her so much to the peoples of Guatemala, and that's how, in fact, she was able to, many years ago, meet Rigoberta Menchú to be with her and her people to see how she could help to stop the genocidal that was taking place in Guatemala. She worked with many organizations throughout, particularly women's organizations. She was a member of the Women's Workshop in the Americas, also being part of the Indigenous Women's Network. I think she was the co-chair of that network. She worked with Madre, very much concerned about the mothers in Central America, mothers and children that were being, you know, killed and raped, and, you know, with the war in Central America. She worked with the International Indian Treaty Council at the United Nations, bringing to the Human Rights Commission all the disappearances and genocide that was taking place around the people, the struggle for the land of indigenous peoples, especially looking at, you know, 500 years. As I said, she felt very strong about 500 years of, you know, that, and to look and say there isn't any changes in 1992. She was the part of the voices around the world that dealt with the resistance of indigenous peoples, and she will say not only indigenous people but of black people around the world, and that there needed to be a change. And Rigoberta Menchú, who in part led a movement in Latin America, she worked very close with her on this. So that was Ingrid, a woman very much concerned about a human being, very much concerned. So it's not surprising that she would have gone to Colombia. She had also been to Central America. She had also been to the Caribbean and been invited by one of the indigenous nations. For her, it was so important. You are who, in fact, we met them on their visits here to the U.S. And knowing that her life could have been in danger, she felt that she had to go and be with them, especially because she's very much concerned about the situation, the culture and traditions of children. This is another aspect that she wanted to look into, how she could help and contribute in that, on that level. So for her to have been massacred the way that she and the others have been is just criminal. Just criminal, Amy.
Well, Esmeralda Brown, that is very important introduction to Ingrid, and I want to thank you. And our condolences go out to you and all the thousands of people in this country who have worked with these three activists and who care deeply about what is happening in Colombia. I know she was also, in addition to being your colleague on so many of these groups, a very dear friend of yours. Esmeralda Brown, chair of the NGO Committee of the United Nations for the International Decade of the World's Indigenous Peoples, a position that Ingrid Washnawatok also held, along with so many others. And we thought we would end today's program with Ingrid's own voice. Ingrid addressed people all over the country, all over the Americas, fighting for indigenous people's rights. And this was a speech she gave in 1992, very active in the campaign of 500 years of resistance, 1992 being the 500th anniversary of Christopher Columbus coming to the Americas. So today we end with Ingrid.
Good evening. It's really, really nice, and I'm honored to be here. It's nice to be here and share the table and the discussion with you all and our other colleagues and panelists. I'm not a scholar. I'm just a res girl who grew up in Chicago and ended up in New York and has been doing some work for the people, and that's basically how I see my work and what I'm doing. It's always for the people, because sometimes the people can't get to where the voices need to be heard. So that's how I started on this road, coming here to New York and working at the International Indian Treaty Council and taking testimonies and documentation of the people from Minnesota, from Arizona, from Guatemala to the UN in Geneva and in New York City. So here I am, and there's so much to say regarding the myths, because there has been so many lies told about all of us. I know the lies that have been told about my people, and I can imagine and know from conversations with other people and friends the lies that have been told about you and Asian people and Chicano people and Hispanic people, everyone. So we know that there are a lot of myths. And what we're trying to do now, as we're discovering the myths and as we know our realities, is to be able to share with that, because so many times the plan has been to isolate us from each other and to keep us apart. We're on reservations. It was just recently that our people came to the cities because they needed work. My dad, my uncles, cousins of mine, other friends, their uncles, their dads, had to leave their reservations to be able to seek employment, to be able to feed the kids. And they ended up in cities like Chicago, Los Angeles, Detroit, Milwaukee, Minnesota, and even here in New York. There's a song by Hugh Masekela that really makes the connection really strong for me when he talks about Stimela, the train that brings everyone from the countries surrounding South Africa and bring them into South Africa to work into the mines. And that's exactly what happened during the 1950s with the relocation policies of the United States that took Indian men, that told them, you don't have a future here on this reservation, that the only place for you to go is to the cities. And that's what started then the urban centers of the United States that have the conclaves of American Indian populations. And the good thing that happened from that was that we were able to, even us, learn about our cousins, learn about ourselves. The intertribal relationships that began to happen grew very strong, and we began to find out things among ourselves. Because what had happened to our people, to my people, my grandmother and grandfather are boarding school kids. The policy of the United States government, and you might have seen a movie back two springs ago. It was called Where the Spirit Lives. And it was about a young girl who was up in Canada and was taken from her home and sent to the residential school in Canada. That's what they call boarding schools up there, to try to take the Indian out of us, to make us white, to make us American. or to make them Canadian, depending wherever you were, and would teach us English and good Christian values like we didn't have any values at all, that their parents, my grandparents, mom and dad, didn't care about them, didn't miss them, didn't love them, didn't nurture them, and took them away many times thousands of miles away. And in the case of my grandmother, who was 6 years old when her and her younger sister left the reservation at age six, went from Keshena, Wisconsin to Shiloko, Oklahoma, to the Shiloko Indian School, which is literally thousands of miles away. And lucky for Grandma, they thought because she had got so sick from missing home that she was going to die, and they sent them back home. So they were lucky enough to be able to go back home to her mom and dad. These are stories that I'm now hearing from my mom and dad. Stories about my grandpa and my dad that they're now finally willing and able to talk about, because the pain that is associated with the denial of everything about your people as bad left such a shame that all of us feel. We all have these stories. We all have stories about how we're sent to school and you're taught about the history of this country, and we're either left out completely or talked about in a very negative way. Justifications for the policies and justifications for what has happened to make America great, to make America strong. And we're just this little insignificant number that happens to be here, and it had to happen that way, or else we wouldn't be this great country as it is. And there you are, a little kid reading this and knowing, even though you might not have been told, because somehow still your parents weren't able to talk about it, you know that there's more to that story. You know that there's more to why we're here and why, as a Menominee young kid, why I'm here. And when we used to open up the books and learn about the history, it started with 1492 and this great guy, Christopher Columbus, who came across. And, you know, it sounded okay. You know, you're kids, you don't know. And it's like, well, yeah, okay, they needed this, you know, and so this guy came over. But then when you know, people think kids don't think, you know, and we all know that we used to think when we were kids, and questions that came to you that you knew that you really weren't supposed to ask. And some of us had the courage to ask. And then we were, of course, severely reprimanded for asking those questions because they didn't go along with the curriculum. They didn't go along with the myth of America and how everything was great and how everything was wonderful. And the question that kept coming into my mind was, well, you know, we were the first people, so why is everything starting with 1492? Where's my history? Where is the lines about, you know, the great, you know, Iroquois Confederacy? Where are the lines about the great people of the plains and what happened when the horse was introduced and how they got to be famous riders? And, you know, as you're sitting around the Christmas dinner table or the Easter dinner table or the family holidays that we celebrated back then, you'd hear the stories. You know, you'd hear the adults talking that after dinner, and they'd be, you know, sitting around visiting, and you'd hear the stories about life on the res, or you'd hear the stories about things that happened in school. And somehow you knew that, well, maybe we're not supposed to ask these things, but you sat with open ears because you knew that you were getting something that you had to know. And so these are the things that we learned, and these were the ways we learned. And now as we move, you know, through the 60s into the 70s, and we're able to watch television shows about ourselves and see our history portrayed on TV, you know, sometimes people, you know, say, oh, that's not how it is. But it is, because we're able to see ourselves finally. And things aren't perfect. It's still Hollywood. It's still the way that, you know, America wants it to be seen. But little by little, those stories are being told. And I think about, when I see these stories, the dedicated people, men and women, plugging away at school, you know, just like with their carrying their books head down, determined to seek out the truth for all of us here. Like I said, I'm not a scholar. I've been able to have these stories related to me. I've been lucky enough to have that, where I've been able to sit down and talk to people. I'm not a reader. I like to hear it. You know, maybe the oral tradition genes are coming out in me, where I, you know, it's really hard for me to read. But as I sit and I hear these stories, and I can imagine the hours and hours of work that, you know, takes place here at Megger and in other places and in the South and in the West, where people are just digging and digging and trying to find out, because we know that there's somewhere more to the story than what's been told to us. So we take a look, and sometimes it gets really, I don't want to use the word scary.
You've been listening to Ingrid Washnawatak, the late Ingrid Washnawatak, who, along with Lahai Gay and Terence Freitas, three Americans killed in Colombia last Thursday. Still, a full investigation of their deaths has not yet taken place. She is Ingrid Washnawatak, a well-known Native American activist and also a former producer at Pacifica Station WBAI in New York. Terence Freitas, with the Project Underground, as well as the UWA Defense Working Group, and Lahai Gay, with the organization that under whose auspices the group went, the Pacific Cultural Conservancy International. Just this note, it's important to note that in the first 6 months of 1998, 619 people were killed in Colombia. And according to Human Rights Watch, 83% of the killings were attributed to paramilitaries and state agents, 17% to guerrillas. They are three Americans killed amongst hundreds and thousands of Colombians over the last years. If you'd like to share your experiences with these human rights activists, you can call our comment line, 212-209-2999. That's 212-209-2999. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can order a cassette by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Special thanks to Samori Marksman and Mario Murillo. Our technical director, Errol Maitland. On this International Working Women's Day, I'm Amy Goodman from the studios of WBAI in New York. Thank you for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!